Hey, this is Miss Melissa, the Bathtub Mermaid, and you are listening to Tales from the Tub. It's the Dog Days of Podcasting, and it is Friday, September 4th, 2015, which means it's the last day of the project. In a fit of either narcissism or awesome cool, I asked my friend Deborah to interview me using my own questions.
Well, the thing is I don't see it as narcissistic. I think it's more like pulling back the curtain. Because the great thing about being the person that asks the questions is you never have to answer them.
That's true.
So in a way, it's kind of like agreeing to turn the tables on yourself.
That's fair. Okay, we'll go with that.
Okay. Well, the first typical question you've been asking everyone is to introduce themselves. And I think that if people are here listening, they probably know you. But I think that what would be interesting, though, is to tell people a little bit more. What do you not typically share in this venue?
What I don't typically share in this venue is this. I am a musician before anything. I think in music. Everything in my life is related to a song. So audio appeals to me because it's pure sound. I'm a writer second. Everything else is improvised. When I was doing mortgages, I was improvising with numbers, not literally, obviously, but it felt like that because really everything is an exercise in improv. But I didn't realize that until after I started doing improv. Thank you, Clay. About 10 years ago.
Yeah.
But yeah, everything in my life comes down to music or writing or improv. And every platform I have is related to one of those things. So there's my blog, which started as just writing practice because I don't believe in writing things no one will read.
Right.
My book blog because I'm a voracious reader and I found a way to monetize that.
Right.
And this because Nutty and Tab said, you should be part of this project. You have a voice and you like to talk.
Well, and the thing is I'm a big believer that we need to do what we love in some way, shape, or form, but we can't just follow our bliss because in a lot of ways that's irresponsible because people would say following my bliss is, well, I don't feel like taking the trash out today and I don't feel like paying my income taxes and I don't, and I call that compassionate discipline. Can you share with us some ways that you apply compassionate discipline in your world?
One of the things is that I actually put on, not necessarily street clothes, but I actually get out of pajamas every day. Sometimes it's at 2:00 in the afternoon, but I actually put on real clothes every day. And when you work from home, you always have this tendency not to do that. The second thing is that when I started working from home, when I left corporate finance, in 2008 and decided I was tired of this and I couldn't cope with corporate life anymore because I was always just passing as a corporate person. And I started doing creative stuff as a living. I made a rule that even on the days when I had no deadline, I would have to do at least one productive thing every day.
Perfect. So speaking of deadlines, no deadlines, doing something productive every day, what is a typical day in the life of Miss Melissa?
Well, for the last 2 weeks, my typical day has been incredibly atypical even for me because, as my listeners know, I blew my knee out on my stairs thanks to one of my dogs. I twisted every ligament. So coming upstairs to my studio has been a challenge, and I really suck at staying in bed. As you and I were just chatting about offline, I have my laptop, a Roku TV, a Kindle, my iPad, and my cell phone, all within fingertips of my bed, and I still get bored. Because someone said, don't move, so then I want to.
Of course.
But my typical day is usually, I am very nocturnal, so I don't typically get up until about 9:30 or 10. I wrangle dogs. We have 5 in the house right now. 4 of them are mine. So it's usually my husband gets up at 6:30 when our Piper puppy likes to get up, and he feeds her and sends her out and then goes back to bed. But the adult dogs don't like to eat until 9:30, and they won't eat unless I'm sitting at the kitchen table. So for the first 2 or 3 hours of my day, I have my laptop at the kitchen table, and I get a lot of writing done in that space because I have the dogs to pay attention to, but they're not really interacting. They're just kind of there.
Mm-hmm.
And about the time that my laptop dies, I take lunch.
Okay.
And then if I have audio projects, I come upstairs and work on them.
Uh-huh.
During the summer, I usually take a swim before I do that.
Okay.
Otherwise, I have a weight machine in my studio, and I use it at least 3 times a week.
Okay.
I find lifting weights really empowering.
Because?
I don't know why. I think because I'm physically pretty small. I'm 5 feet tall.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the fact that I can move mass is just really kind of cool.
Okay.
but also because it's not something that a lot of women really do. I mean, we have little, like, you know, handheld barbells, and they're usually pink, but I have actual weight plates. And there's this site called StumpToUs.com that has some really, really good weightlifting advice for women. And one of the things that it says is that, you know, unless you're taking metabolic steroids, you are not going to look all muscle-bound and gross.
Right, right. Well, I mean, personally, I'm a fan of weights, but I do have dumbbells, but they're not pink. They're the old fashioned metal dumbbells with the numbers on them. And
oh, see, they're old school. That's
right. Cool. And they range from, let's see, there's an 8, a 10, a 20, and a 15 sets in here. So 4 sets.
Okay, say, that's real dumbbells. I mean, you know, usually they have the ones like at Target that are like the little exercise aisle.
Right, that are
aisle.
2 pounds.
Yeah.
What's the point of that?
Like, my purse weighs more than that most days.
Exactly.
So I have this weight machine. It's the brand of it is Marcy, so I call it Marcy's Playground. Because, you know me, I love the pun.
Exactly.
So I work usually until about 6, which is when the dogs start getting restless for dinner. And either I will go down and feed them, or I will go downstairs and sit with them while someone else feeds them, because, again, they won't eat without me present.
Right.
My dogs are the most neurotic creatures on earth. I have the only dogs that have to be coaxed to eat.
No.
Other than Becca.
I know Becca's don't.
But, yeah, all of them. They're neurotic, and they won't eat unless I'm home and they can see me. It's weird. After dinner, we usually don't eat until, like, 8 or 8:30. We're very European. After dinner, or we usually watch maybe 1 or 2 hours of television, and then we go to our separate corners, and I usually write something fun or read until 2 or 3 in the morning.
Okay. Which is one of the reasons you talked about being nocturnal, because,
yes,
you know, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm thinking about getting up.
I've always been nocturnal. When I was doing that, my 100 days of note cards, one of the snippets that I did was from one of the first conversations I had with my stepfather after my parents got married.
Mm-hmm.
When I was 12 or 13. He had come into my room at like 2 in the morning on a Saturday night and said, "It's really late. Shouldn't you be asleep?" And I just looked at him and said, "Shouldn't you?" And eventually, over those 2 a.m. conversations, we forged a friendship.
Yeah. I mean, that's usually when it happens, though. You know? I mean, it's those unexpected moments that we build things. And building things. You talked about, you know, thinking and musing and music being your first passion. What really does set your soul on fire?
Music especially, but any kind of language also. I love playing with sound, and I love playing with language. If you live in my house, you will very quickly find that my life is a musical, and it's usually improvised. I am constantly making up songs about whatever. Every dog has their own song.
Okay.
No, I'm not going to sing them on the air. I parodize songs at will, usually without wanting to. But language in general. The other day, someone posted video that was all about the collective nouns for animals. And a lot of them, most of them I knew, but the one about the school of a group of sharks being a shiver really struck my imagination because, you know, I have a thing for sharks.
Right.
So I actually, today's blog post was all about my playing with A Shiver of Sharks, and there's like a three-line flashback that went with it.
Perfect. Perfect. So how do you get your inspiration for writing?
There's a line in the movie Music and Lyrics. It's a several-year-old Hugh Grant, Drew Barrymore film, and it's not the best movie, but it really talks a lot about the collaborative process. And he has a line in it where he goes, "Inspiration is for amateurs. You can't wait for inspiration."
Right.
I do not entirely agree, but I will say that inspiration comes in the weirdest places. I am inspired by random things. I'm inspired by overheard conversations. A couple years ago, I wrote a piece that was inspired by the fact that I ran into a stranger in the doorway of Starbucks and something about him just struck me on a cosmic level.
Mm-hmm.
Weather is always a strong influence on me. Music is always a strong influence. I like songs that have really good lyrics because I like storytelling. So I find a lot of inspiration in that.
Well, speaking of storytelling, I mean, we can always talk forever about story. And but what books have been most impactful to you? And I know you read, you know, a book a day sort of thing, but what's the most recent thing you've read that you want people to say, "Hey, you need to pick this up because I think you would love it"?
It's not the most recent book that I've read, but there are three books that I recommend to everybody. Everybody. Actually four, and I'm going to tell you all of them because it's my show, so I get to cheat.
Right.
The first one is a book called Outside Lies Magic by John R. Stilgo. Oh. It's like 20 or 30 years old, and it's about like a cultural anthropology, cultural socialism, popular science kind of book. And it's all about being an explorer in the everyday world. It's about how things like, if you understand the history of the American highway system, you know that there's a reason we have these long, straight stretches of highway, especially in the Midwest, because they were really designed as part of the defense system, and it's designed so that planes have a place to land in an emergency. But it's stuff like that. It's stuff like, if you walk down old Main Streets, you can see how the shift from Main Street USA to Highway USA has taken place just by looking at the architecture. And one of the things that struck me most about that book, even though I read it like 20 or 30 years ago, because I heard about it on NPR and was struck by it, is that the mail system has been evolving not just recently with budget issues, but even like 10 or 20 years ago, we used to have normal residential pickup and delivery was twice a day. And it was actually changed because if you lived in a city with twice a day pickup, you could get overnight delivery for the price of a normal stamp.
Mm-hmm.
So things like that always strike me, and I really enjoyed the book, and it's really well written. It is probably the equivalent of Blink for its day.
Okay.
The second one is, and I never remember her last name, it just went out of my head, the author's last name is Ackerman, and I'll look it up and put it in notes. A Natural History of the Senses. I think it's Diane.
Okay.
A Natural History of the Senses, which is, again, it's sort of creative nonfiction pop science, but it's all about how our senses work. And it's written in this beautiful lyrical language that's just, it makes you want to crawl inside it and just write poetry about life.
Okay.
The third one is Alexandra Stoddard's Gift of a Letter.
Okay.
And I know that you're familiar with that.
Actually, I think you gave me that when I moved here.
I still write paper letters. I collect stationery. I love pens. I think letters are very special. Even though they don't have the immediacy of email, they're something you can keep. And what they do act as is a sort of very small time capsule of one moment in time. And so her book is all about how letter writing is more than just the act of putting a stamp on an envelope. It's also the act of a connection with the person you're writing to. And one of the things that really struck me about that book was she said, you know, sometimes you have something that you got as a gift, like a salad bowl or whatever, and you may have been using it for years, but sometimes it's nice to say to the person who gave it to you, you know what, I've been using this salad bowl for years, and I just wanted to let you know that I still use it every day.
Yes. Yeah.
And then the fourth one is fiction, and it's this massive novel that was written, I think it was released in 1999, called The Eight by Catherine Neville. It is a historical mystery romantic comedy adventure epic that involves Charlemagne's legendary chess set, Bishop Talleyrand, alchemy, and chess. And it takes place in two time periods, the 1790s and the 1970s, at the dawn of OPEC. And it's parallel stories about the search for this legendary chess set, which is supposed to hold the secret to the elixir of life. The actual adventure is fun, but the other part that's fun is seeing all the historical figures worked into it. It's just a great story.
Perfect. Perfect. Well, but what about recently? Have you read anything recently that, like this year, what have you read so far this year that you would say, I love these kind of lists. I mean, I was in a meeting with a bunch of other coaches earlier today, and one of the ladies was saying, well, what kind of resources would you put together for, you know, a group of parents? And I said, well, why not have, you know, a list of books to read already in place about different issues that come up with childhood or in divorce and, you know, links ready. Those sort of things are great. So what recent have you read?
I just read a couple of months, like maybe a month ago or earlier this month, a novel called The Last Summer at Chelsea Beach.
Okay.
And it's historical romance. I don't usually read romances because I just don't. It's not that I don't like them. I think they're a very valuable piece of literature in terms of being, you know, entertainment fiction. And I think there's an absolute reason to have things that are just fun and entertaining and mind candy. This is a little deeper than that. It's a Harlequin Mira print. Uh-huh. So it's one of their more substantial lines.
Okay.
It takes place at the beginning of, I can't remember if it's World War, it's like the interwar period. So it's between World War I and World War II. And it's about an Italian Jewish immigrant to the States and her life, having been adopted as a sort of sister but to this Irish American Catholic family.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all about her adventures as she becomes a journalist and finds her own agency. But what I really thought was interesting was that we see all these interwar and World War II stories where we have a Jewish immigrant, and they're always just Jewish, and she was also Italian, and I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, that is really cool. Okay, see, now I've got something to add to my list that's recent, too. Which
I think I have it in hardcover if you want it.
Okay, that'd be great. You know, and speaking of hardcover and families and stories and, you know, I think one of the other things that you and I have in common is a love of food. And not just food as, I mean, again, it still ties to that same thing we talked about so much, that food isn't about sustenance. Food is life. Food is story.
Food is story, and food is culture, and food is family. And breaking bread with someone, whether they're someone you've just met or someone you've known forever, is one of the easiest ways to also break ice.
Right. And so if you were to put together a dinner party of imaginary, historical people, what three people would be on that list?
See, you're letting me cheat a lot.
Yeah.
Okay, Spalding Gray. The storyteller,
uh-huh.
He committed suicide several years ago, but I've been a fan of his since I was probably too young to really comprehend the groundbreaking work he was doing. My 21st birthday present from my parents was seeing him live in performance, and it was profound. But I think he would be a really interesting conversationalist if he was not in a depressed mood that day.
Mm-hmm.
Louisa May Alcott, because I've always loved her work, and I think she, as a person, is much more interesting than we give her credit for.
Mm-hmm.
And also Laura Ingalls Wilder, for similar reasons, because if nothing else, I want to know the truth about how much of her work was really hers and how much was her daughter Rose's.
Oh, okay.
There's lots of speculation, and it runs the gamut from, yes, it was totally collaborative, to no, Rose wrote everything, to no, Laura wrote everything, and I suspect it's somewhere between all of
those. Okay, okay. And see, because that's not been my series of books to read, you know, I haven't followed the Laura
when
saga,
I was,
but I know that you have.
Well, I started reading them when I was very, very young, when I was like 4 or 5, which was just about the time the television series started. So I literally grew up with them. Mm-hmm. And the books are so much better than the series. Yeah. If you haven't read them, I find that even as an adult, because even though they're technically children's books, they were written at a time when there was not such this marked division between what's a children's book and what isn't.
Right. It was just books.
But it's very simple language, so they're accessible to children. But if you pay attention to the history of the day, there's a lot of interesting stuff. And like one of the things that made them more relevant to me was that the bulk of the novels take place in South Dakota, where my husband is from. So when I moved there, when we got married, it became real.
Right, because you were there physically in that space.
Yeah, my nieces and nephews went to Laura Wilder Elementary School. The road that we used to travel to get to his parents' farm was the Laura Ingalls Wilder Historical Highway, and I have stood in her house.
Yeah.
So it became very relevant and very real. And then I found out that even though she would never have called herself a feminist, she was actually, she had a lot of agency for women of her time. She was a journalist. She was one of the founders of, it just went out of my head. Not independent, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
She was very politically independent.
Yeah, independent. She was very kind of thought.
Yeah. And she just, whatever she had to do to survive, she figured out a way to do it.
Well, you know, and that brings me, you know, we've talked about feminism. It's interesting. You've got two feminists on here, too, because actually Louisa May Alcott was very much a feminist. She was the first woman to ever vote because her mother had fought for women's right to vote locally and died right before the election came. And so Louisa May got to take that first vote in Massachusetts.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, and so it's interesting you do this. I have this, like, you know, since I was a Laura fan, but, you know, we have these imaginary things that we think about these people that we believe we know, right? And so after visiting, you know, because I was in Concord last month and sent you some stationery from there and stuff, but so now...
Yeah, and I can't use it. I just have to have it.
And I have this whole new theory about, you know, Louisa May and her life, and I have to share it with you offline someday.
Did we talk about that?
No, we haven't.
There is her stand-in for Emerson, who she had a crush on.
Yeah, and you know, and the thing is I think that's part of it, you know. Well, I mean, we may as well get into it a little bit, you know, because this is, I think this is fascinating. And if it isn't fascinating, we can cut this part out of the interview, even though I know you hate slicing. But, you know, she never married. And, you know, of course, there was speculation that she was a lesbian. And, you know, that wasn't acceptable. But you also have to look at the time period. I mean, she was in a time period that was, she was the household member that went to war. She was a Civil War nurse. And, you know, we lost volumes of young men at that period that would have been marryable.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and so you have all of these old maids, basically. But I think it was a cross between, I think she always loved Emerson. He helped their family out so much. And so I think she did have that little girl crush on him, of this great thinker and man who so thought so much of her father that's why they live basically across the street from each other. Yeah. Right. But on the flip side, you know, as much as she loved her father, he was just an intellectual, and he, you know, because of him, they were poor. And I think she never wanted to give up her financial freedom to a man. I think she felt it was safer to rely upon only herself. And I think that's one of her quotes is that, you know, I'd rather paddle my own canoe.
She said that a lot.
And I think it was really because as much as she loved her father and he shaped how she thought, and he was really, you know, one of the birthers of that transcendentalist movement along with Emerson and Thoreau. I think she saw how hard her mother worked, and she was determined that she wasn't going to be poor because of a man.
I agree.
And so that's a lot of my theories. But I do think that she had that big crush on Emerson. And, you know, when you fall in love as an impressionable young woman, with someone that's like a hero figure that truly is, not just like an imaginary white knight, but someone that you've seen in action and you see that he is a good man and a smart man and a thoughtful man. How does the average farm boy compare?
He doesn't.
Yeah. So I think that's where, and I guess that's kind of leads into another question of, you know, how do you believe we find that love, that connection, that willing to lay it down and say, yes? I mean, you and Fuzzy have been married for a really long time.
20 years. Yeah. It'll be 21 in March.
Yeah. And so how do you think, you know, instead of just advice, like, what is the number one piece of relationship advice you ever got about, you know, relationships and marriage and love and that sort of thing?
The most important piece of advice I have ever gotten was from my mother, who is everything to me. And she has this letter she writes to everyone in my family when they turn 60, all the women in my family as they turn 16 or 18 or 21, depending on the person. And it's universal advice. I think I've even given it to your daughter, passed it on. And what she says is this: don't get married until you have seen the world, lived on your own for at least a year, and had at least one truly tragic love affair.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's really important for women to experience, especially independence, before they tie themselves to anyone. Because even in our generation and this next generation coming up behind me, there are women and girls who go from mom and dad's house to their married house and never taste their own life.
Yeah. I believe that.
So I think a lot of it is that, because if you haven't gone through those things, you really don't know what you want. The other thing she will always say, and I agree, that, and I know that my conservative relatives are going to hate this, is you don't have to marry the first person you sleep with.
Yeah.
It's okay if you do, if that works for you, but you don't have to.
Yes.
As to how I found Fuzzy, I found him online. I hit a Google search for awesome farm boy and got lucky. We met on a mush, so we actually were interacting online for like a year before we ever met in person.
Yeah. See, and I think those are the things that make up, because they put such a layer of who we are, right? And where our stories come from, even if people don't know the back story.
Oh, absolutely.
So to speak. So would you say that is like the best piece, not just about relationships, but the best advice you ever got?
The only other thing I can think of that's better. No, I think that I don't really think you can top that. I think collectively that's really good advice. The only other thing I can think of is use the good china.
Mm. Yeah, I'm a big fan of that.
And I know that I talked about that with Becca, and I think I talked about it with someone else when I was doing these all month, that you can't just put things on the shelf forever. If you have these pretty things, you should make them part of your day, because why?
Yeah, why have them if not? So how do you shake yourself out of those moods when you want to throw the china instead of putting it on the table?
There have been times that I have thrown china, but it's rare because I don't like to clean stuff up. And knowing me, I'll step on something. There are a couple of things I do. One of them is that I have a playlist on iTunes that's like my bitchy, angry girl music.
Mm-hmm.
It starts with Meredith Brooks' Bitch. It includes Sparker Girl by Letters to Cleo.
Huh?
And the Joan Jett version of I Love Rock and Roll, because it's coarser than the Britney Spears version.
Right.
I like it better. So music always helps. The other thing is water. If I go take a bath or take a swim, it always shakes me out of whatever I'm in.
Okay. Perfect. Well, you know, we haven't really talked about charities, but I know that you – lean to the left, so to speak, in a lot of ways.
Only a little.
But if you had to choose just one place to put your money and your time as far as charities, what would that be?
Money and time for me are different, because I don't have the ability to put time in where I would really like to. So time for me is all about the dogs, because it's something that I can do within my own house just by hosting a dog or helping to drive them back and forth and stuff like that. There are three charities that are on all my blogs. One of them is First Book, one of them is Habitat for Humanity, and the other one is Planned Parenthood. And I think especially right now, Planned Parenthood is where most of my dollar donations go.
Awesome. Well, do you want to tell people that may have stumbled upon this interview via a blog post or a Facebook post or something like that, how they can connect with you in all the places?
All of the information for this interview is in the credits at the end of the show, but if you want to see my writing, you should go to missmeliss.com, and if you want to see what I'm reading, you should go to bibliotica.com, and all of my email and contact links are on those pages.
Perfect.
And I also want to let everyone know that Deborah, who very kindly interviewed me, did an interview earlier this month that you can find at bathtubmermaid.com, but you can also find her at deborahspouse.com. Bathtub Mermaid is written and produced by Melissa A. Bartell and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Sharealike 4.0 International License. Music for this episode was provided by Mebio's Music Alley, a great resource for PodSafe music. Visit them at music.mebio.com. The opening song is Soap in a Bathtub by Stony. The closing song is You Can Use My Bathtub by Little Tom. The Bathtub Mermaid is produced and recorded using BossJock and Audacity. You can contact me by leaving a comment at the website, www.bathtubmermaid.com, by finding me on Twitter, at Meliss, M-E-L-Y-S-S-E, or by sending an email to Meliss, M-E-L-Y-S-S-E, at starfleet.com. Thanks for listening, and remember, never let your bathwater get too cold. Deep inside. And still it shows. But you can use my bathtub. Understand, you can use my bathtub. Yes, you can.